This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Railroads have always been an important part of economic development in North Carolina. But up until the late 19th century, the terrain of western North Carolina left folks in Asheville pretty much out of the picture. That was until the state-owned Western North Carolina Railroad Company began boring through the mountains and laying down track. Once the first steam engine rolled into town, things changed quickly. Tourists began rushing into the region, and industries like mining and timber started to boom. A new exhibit at the Rural Heritage Museum at Mars Hill University examines this pivotal era in the region's history. The exhibit is called How the West Was Won, Trains and the Transformation of Western North Carolina. I'm joined now by two guests at our partner station WCQS in Asheville. Lee Raker is the museum's director. Welcome back, Les Raker. Hello, Les, and welcome back.
Hello, and thank you for having me again.
Also joining us, Ray Rapp. He curated the exhibit, also a former member of the North Carolina House of Representatives. Hello, Ray.
Hello. I'm glad to be with you, Frank.
Ray, tell us a little bit about the idea of the rail line in western North Carolina. When did the idea come to people? When did construction actually begin?
Well, it's a historian. You can go back many years and talk about many dates. As early as 1827, Joel Poinsett down in Charleston, South Carolina, was talking about connecting the then Northwest, which is today's Midwest, with the southeastern United States by rail, coming from Charleston up along the French Broad River to the Ohio Valley. And he published pamphlets, pushed the idea for many years, but it was a daunting challenge, and it really lay dormant for about 20 years. But the North Carolina legislature, when it began authorization in 1849 of the North Carolina Railroad, also authorized a connection to Tennessee through the Blue Ridge Mountains. And in 1852, survey work was done to lay out the routes, which in later years would become the railroad into the mountains.
What was the genesis of that? Obviously, if the legislature is taking this on, it seems to be an important kind of public policy issue. What was the value of that railroad for the state?
Well, let me start first with the local folks. In the 1840s, there was a famine in the mountains out here. And there was a great hue and cry among the people that were scattered in settlements around the mountains, but to have access to a transportation system that was reliable so that they could get foodstuffs into the mountains when we were having droughts or difficult times. So that there was that internal effort to bring the railroad to the mountains, but externally, we had folks that were very much aware of the timber, which in subsequent years, billions of board feet would be moved out of here. They were aware of things such as the copper mines, which are today called Copper Hill, Tennessee, just over the line in western North Carolina. We were aware of feldspar. We were aware of mica. There had been gold mining in the 1840s through the 50s in the lower parts of the mountains themselves. So there was this rich plethora of minerals, ores to be mined, but you can get to smaller mines. One was the Cranberry Iron Ore Mine, with some of the purest iron ore in the country, which was in Cranberry, North Carolina. The issue was, you could only take it out with crude wagons over crude roads, which was unreliable. And we had a growing industrial economy that demanded large amounts of iron ore, large amounts of feldspar, large amounts of timber. And the most efficient and effective way to get those materials out of the mountains was by rail.
So the idea had been around for a while. There are plenty of good reasons to do that. Now it takes a couple of individuals as well to make it happen. One of them is Major James H. Wilson, who played an important part. Ray, tell us a bit about him.
Very interesting figure who was a state legislator himself at one time and helped to convince his fellow legislators to fund an additional $850,000 to build the road from Salisbury, complete it to Asheville, coming up the old Fort Loops. But he was named president of the railroad. He was its chief engineer. He was from Morganton, by the way. He had a construction company in Morganton. He was ahead of that construction company, and they contracted with the railroad for the services. He was a land investor. He was also the largest shareholder in the Western North Carolina Railroad. This was a public-private partnership, and he owned 1,400 shares of the railroad stock. So he had it all integrated, and he did one other thing. As they were building the famous old Fort Loops up the mountain, and those loops are 9 miles of loops to go about 3.1 miles as a crow flies, he decided that we need to attract people to these mountains as well. He knew what they could get out, but he wanted to bring people in. So he built at the foot of the mountain the Round Knob Hotel. And believe it or not, Frank, he built a geyser. Now, if someone looks up.
I didn't know that's how they got there. Well, tell us about the man-made geyser.
Yeah. Well, he was an engineer, and what he did was he needed an attraction. Now, so he built a hotel at the foot of the mountain, at the Loops, and he said, now we got to have some kind of an attraction to get people here. So he built a pond up on the mountainside, and through the use of ever-decreasing sized pipes, he forced that water down to his created geyser, which shot the water about 250 feet in the air, and it was quite a sight. In fact, when you took the train up the mountain, people could see that from about 8 different locations, and a number of people would say, we didn't know you had that many geysers in Western North Carolina.
Well, let's talk about the exhibit itself. You've called this one of the most important installations you've had at the Rural Heritage Museum. Tell us why.
Yes, it's really important to this region. Got the idea for putting this on about a year ago. And I met with Ray, and we discussed it. And this has been a lifelong passion of his to bring this recognition of the importance of the railroad to the public. We talked about it, and we worked on it really hard for about 6 months. And what you have when you come into the exhibition, which I'll tell you in a minute, but what we've really presented are a number of things that show you how the railroads transformed the area. That was the impetus for this, not necessarily to make it be an exhibition about railroads, because it is, but their impact on this region.
Well, Ray, tell me a little bit more about the railroad. You talked about these loops that you have to create as you're going uphill just to get a couple of miles. You had to blow through those mountains and make holes. How difficult was it, and what did it take to bring the track up the mountains?
Well, it was a heroic feat. It truly was, because there are no foothills coming into the mountains of Western North Carolina. And if you drive on Interstate 26 coming from Spartanburg into Asheville, or if you come on Interstate 40 up the Old Fort Mountain into Black Mountain and then Asheville, you have these very steep 6% grades, because there's no gentle foothills to gradually build up your elevation. So faced with this challenge, they used basically three techniques. Major Wilson came up and led the charge on the mountain, and it was a charge on the mountain, to build 9 miles of loops to go 3.1 miles as the crow flies. When I talk about loops, there's 2,770 degrees of curvature on that mountain. You complete the equivalent of 8 circles before you get from Old Fort to the top of the mountain in Swannanoa. So it was really a challenge. But the construction was to used 1,455 men, mostly convict laborers brought from Central Prison in Raleigh. And just as an aside, 85% of the prisoners in Central Prison in Raleigh after the Civil War were put on work assignments for internal improvements in the state, railroads being one of those, also for farm work, but they were not sitting in their prison cells in Raleigh. They were sent out, in the case of the railroad, in boxcars. They literally slept in boxcars, many of them. Overnight, they were locked in for the night, but then worked on the railroad during the day. Well, there were 1,455 men. There were 403 boys employed and over 1,000 mules, horses, and oxen to build these 9 miles of loops up the mountain. And in John Ely's novel, The Road, it tells the story, while it's a fine novel. He was on the staff of Governor Sanford in 1960 when he went each night over to the official records of the Western North Carolina Railroad in Archives and History. And what he documents accurately is what it took to build those loops up the mountain. There are 7 tunnels. They use the crudest form of construction techniques. And when I say that, it was very hard to get black powder into the South at that time. There was still concern about the Ku Klux Klan. So the price of black powder made it prohibitive. So some of the things they did, for example, they would take pine. Pine gives you a quick fire, very hot flame, and they would build these fires under these huge boulders. And then they would sluice cold mountain water down on the rock, and the rock would break open. Then they would have the convict laborers begin to break up that rock into smaller pieces. But I use that as an example of just how crude the techniques were in building these the tunnels and the loops. The other thing they did, which is in the novel by John Ely, The Road, entitled The Road, but they dragged, hear me, they dragged an engine from the foot of the mountain over 3 miles above what was called the turnpike, was a dirt road is what it was. They dragged this engine so that they could dig the Swannanoa Tunnel, 1,834-foot tunnel, so they could dig it from the east and the west simultaneously. Hmm. And they did, and in March of 1879, believe it or not, they met dead center in that tunnel.
Yeah, because there's a tragedy in the making. You know, every one of the cartoons I saw as a kid, that ends up badly. But luckily, they met in the middle. Les, you said the important thing about this is the impact that it had. Tell us what happened when that first steam engine rolled into Asheville.
Well, when that steam engine rolled into Asheville on October 3rd, 1880, it changed everything. And there are several industries that came in. A very important one was lumber. And lumber was needed in the North and the Midwest for building homes, for building factories. And the area here in Western North Carolina was denuded. The old-growth timber was removed, and it was barren for quite a while after that. They also came in, as Ray mentioned, for mining, to come in and get mica and feldspar and iron and quartz and copper and barite, talc, sulfur, silver, a number of elements that were here waiting in the mountains. And so the railroads were important for bringing those out. And the mining continues today in an area called Spruce Pine here in the mountains. There's a large mine owned by a company called Unimin that continues to mine for feldspar. Today, tourists come through the area, and you can see roadside jam mining and so on, which is really a remnant of the past. But this was a really rich area, so it was important for them to, for these industries, to bring those natural resources out of the mountains using the railroad.
A guy named Vanderbilt had something to do with the railroads and also the kind of tourist industry. He found Asheville an attractive place. I wonder if there is that just a coincidence? He just wanted a mountain getaway, and he had the money to do it, I guess.
He and his mother visited here in 1877. She came to escape the smog of New York City. He took a look out in the Blue Ridge Mountains and really fell in love, and subsequently purchased 125,000 acres of land that is surrounding this region, and built what came to be America's largest private home, the Biltmore Estate, using Frederick Law Olmsted and Richard Morris Hunt, the two famous landscape architects and architects to build what is become a real treasure and a gem of this region.
You know, but it didn't take a fake geyser to attract him to the region. The mountain, apparently, enough for the captain of industry. Ray, let me ask you a question. This is one of the interesting little side facts in all of this. You talked about the steep grades that they faced. In fact, pretty much too much for trains to get up, and they were always going off the track. Somebody came up with a solution for that very quickly. Can you tell us that story?
Well, very quickly, there was an engineer called William Pitt Ballou who was based in Asheville, and he was taking a train down Saluda Mountain. Saluda Mountain is between Asheville and Spartanburg, and he wrecked his engine on the mountain, as there had been numerous wrecks before that, and he was taken to the hospital in Asheville. He woke up in the middle of one night and in what the nurses thought was a fevered state because he was yelling, "I got it, I got it." Well, what he got was the idea of runaway ramps, and your listeners will see runaway ramps in the mountains for trucks on I-26, I-40, most of your major mountain highways. But the idea came from Saluda Mountain and Pitt Ballou. Now, they didn't pay any attention to him when he called the superintendent from his hospital bed. But in August, they had another wreck. And in September, they had a third wreck in 1903. So three wrecks in 3 months. And the superintendent called him and said, "What was that idea you had about runaway ramps?"
I got to ask you again, real quick. I think of a runaway ramp with a truck, you just kind of go off the road into the sand, but trucks right. can steer left and right. Now, trains, it's a track, and usually somebody's got to stand on the outside, pull a lever to get you on the track. How did it work?
Well, that worked with you would be switched if you were going more than 8 miles an hour down the mountain.
So you needed somebody had to stand there and see you were in trouble.
That's right. Okay. It was done electronically in later years, but it's a 10% grade.
Whoa.
With sand and trees at the end of it.
I see.
About 1,000 feet in length. You would not stop a runaway train. And in fact, one of the engineers of a coal train described it to me this way. He said, "Picture yourself sitting in an engine with 90,000 tons of coal pushing you down the mountain, because that's what happens. So if you lose it," they had to, their expression, "join the birds."
Gone
just
forever.
Jump.
We will leave us all with that picture. Ray Rapp, curator of the exhibit, How the West Was Won, Trains and the Transformation of Western North Carolina. Les Raker is the director of the Rural Heritage Museum. Find out about it at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.